Welcome, folks, to Taboo Topic. I am one of the hosts, Ken Drew, and I am joined by my other co-host, Tony. How are you doing, Tony? And I am also joined by a new co-host, Aaron. How are you, sir?
Yo, doing good. Thank you.
Awesome. Now, how are you guys doing overall? Like, how does this feel like being in a three-way conversation right now?
That's kind of the default for me. It's actually more rare that I'm talking to just one person at a time. So, yeah, that's about the norm.
Okay. What about you, Aaron?
When you say three-way conversation, I was reminded of middle school when, like, did you guys used to, like, have long phone calls with your friends, like, on school nights or the weekends, and you do the three-way calling, but usually just be one person ranting while the other people listen?
I think I had, I have a memory of that, too, when I was in middle school, so.
I do not.
Nope.
I figure the idea of having multiple people in the same phone call was a complete alien to me until maybe sometime during high school, after I had already gotten a cell phone. Up until that point, when we still had like a landline phone, the phone was it was just like the old days where it was just a string connecting two phones to the other, you know? And that was that. It was just one phone led to another phone. There was no third person involved. That was always my conception for a long time.
That's novel.
That's funny. So, with that said, we are having a new set of topics we're going to talk about this week. First topic, both of these topics, we talked about it in the last Tangent Train edition, where we talked about AI, but we also talked about fatherhood pre-industrialization period and how this new movement to work from home is a public good for fathers and families in general. And I'm going to let Tony take lead because you're the one that kind of brought it up last time, and you're the one that seems to have knowledge about this area. And I want Aaron also to kind of chime in where you feel appropriate anyway, being a father yourself. But Tony, you mind going ahead and taking the lead in this topic?
Yeah. So there's a couple of, I would say there's three different levels of AI that is important to clarify, first of all, which is that you have the idea of an algorithm, which is just, it's just a something that is good with pattern recognition and outputs a solution that you identify you would like for the algorithm to output. We see algorithms in use on Facebook and YouTube and Google and everywhere else, and pretty much everyone knows what it is at this point, to just be like, it's a general computer business that will identify what your interests are and try to match you with content that fits your interests, or is manipulated to, you know, skew your interests depending on who's talking, right? Then the second level is generative AI, being things like ChatGPT or like image generating AI things such as Playground AI or Midjourney, a few others that are pretty big names in the field of just things where you can input some sort of words or idea or maybe an image already and say, do something else with this image, and it'll, you know, output a different product. And we're getting better and better at making those products very hard to distinguish from a human being's product, right? That a lot of AI is already better than the vast majority of people in its ability to produce pictures, certainly, but even with text and linguistics in general, music prediction, that kind of stuff, there's a lot that generative AIs are already surpassing people in. And then you have sci-fi AI, which is the idea of a robot that behaves in a way that makes it hard to distinguish from a person, right? So you have different films and video games where you are either viewing or even controlling a character who, by all empathetic ability to perceive this character, they appear to be human. We're told verbally that they're not human, or there's something in the narrative that tries to remind you that, you know, oh, there's this schism between where they are and where we are. But ultimately, the goal is to try to blur that line between what is human and what is not. And a game that does that really well was, Detroit Become Human, right? It was just a certain video game that does a pretty good job of asking those questions of, like, what is the distinction that makes humans different, right? One of the biggest criticisms that my older brother has about those sorts of stories is that you'll never see them. They always make the relatable human acting AIs human, right? They'll always be a human body, often attractive. And there's something subconscious about that that makes us like them more, which makes us want to empathize with them more. But if you had the exact same character personality profile and you put it into a little like cardboard box looking body, people wouldn't be able to emotionally connect with it because it wouldn't look like human and it would be more obvious that it's not human. And so even if it was able to do all of this, even if it said all the same lines and performed all of the same actions, there would still be a stronger distinction and we'd be able to say, oh, it's clearly a robot and not a person. So that is an objection to how that third level of AI is typically portrayed, is that they're basically human and the only difference between them and us is the fact that we're just not there yet. That's all. That is what right. A lot of sci-fi puts out into as their conjecture.
Mm-hmm.
So where we're at right now is basically that second level. We have graduated from algorithms and we are currently improving generative AI and working on consolidating those generative AI into as few different models as possible, meaning that we're trying to make it so that instead of having ChatGPT for text, Midjourney for images, and the new Google one, video AI, what is it called? Not Lumiere, but I think it starts with an S. I can't remember it. Point being, Sima, S-I-M-A, I think is what I'm coming up with, that instead of having these different products that produce their specific niche of content, what people are going to eventually start doing is trying to say, how many of these different things can we put into one unit? Right now, if you look up Tesla Generation 2, I think it's like called Prime or something like that, Optimus. So Tesla built a robot. They called it Optimus. Currently, they're on Generation 2 of it. And it is astonishing how far robotics have come when you look at what that thing is capable of, with how it's actually getting to the point where robots are able to walk in a pretty convincing way. And the dexterity in its hands are actually such that it can understand complex instructions. And most importantly is that instead of teaching it how to run a pre-programmed simulation of this is how you walk, this is how you turn corners, instead what Tesla has done with put an AI structure in it so that it will say, this method of walking didn't work for me last time, so this other method of walking was more efficient and effective, so therefore I will walk more like this next time. Or it will say, I detect that the room has changed, which means there is now a person in front of me, so therefore I have to step out of the way in order to proceed on my path. So it's no longer just about teaching it how to run a course, but teaching it how to react to the environment that it's in, right? Then it's a big leap for its ability to adapt to new circumstances, and that's one of the things that currently is one of the biggest separators between people and robots, is our ability to adapt and overcome obstacles, right?
All right.
So the goal over time, to wrap this all up into a conclusion that I'll then hand it off to you guys to proceed from, the goal over time is going to be to figure out how few of these different elements we can get until eventually we just have one Android looking robot that can generate all of the content that these different cells can do, right? To get Tesla's Optimus robot to be ChatGPT, to draw the art, to speak the lines, to record the videos, and to sell it on the internet for money, right? How can we get it to the point where one thing is able to automate all of it so that we can then focus on making that one thing better instead of making all of these different elements better at the same time?
That's
where we're at. And then the next stage after that would be the closest thing we can get to those sci-fi stories.
Wow. Aaron, how does that, what do you think about when you hear all that about AI? Like, what are your impressions about AI in general when someone talks about that? And what are your first impressions from the things that Tony just talked about?
So as a author, as a writer, I found certain AI programs like ChatGPT or Midjourney to be really helpful for me in my work. Like, sometimes I'll have like an idea, but I just don't know quite how to flesh that idea out. So having a program where I can ask it to help me come up with original ideas based on, some of the influences that I've had or inspirations that I've had, and flesh out a completely new concept based on the feedback that I get from, we'll say ChatGPT, for instance, it's very helpful to me, because otherwise I have to spend hours, sometimes days, trying to figure out how to best make this idea come to life. Whereas since I started using ChatGPT, that reduces it into a night's or a day's work, not less.
Yeah.
So it's very helpful to that degree. Now, when Tony started talking about Optimus and androids and things like that, the first things that come to mind are like The Matrix, iRobot, things like that. My biggest concern overall is integrating all of those AI concepts into one thing. I think poses a huge danger to mankind. Now, I mean, from a Christian point of view, I trust that God's sovereign over all things. I don't think that this will cause, or it's hard to really say, I guess. It's hard to really interpret like AI into eschatology, you know?
Yeah. Enough.
But so maybe not going too far into that realm, but just like, you know, with the understanding that I do trust that God's sovereign over all things, and that if AI, I almost want to say when AI becomes a threat to mankind to one degree or another, that God is sovereign over that. And man, it is a bit of an alarming thought, because I think in the early 2000s, when I was watching things like iRobot and The Matrix, thinking like, man, that might be possible in 500 to 1,000 years, maybe. And now it's like, oh, that's probably possible in my lifetime. And that's, to me, like, that's it. When I was younger, when I saw those movies, the thought was like, man, if I were alive in the time when we can make things like this happen, then I need to be prepared. And it's like, oh, I need to be prepared.
Yeah.
The biggest thing I'll say, just in my thought, sorry, is not necessarily warfare, because actually it would be a great thing if we could put robots against robots, and whoever's robots win, then the winners. And it's like, oh, nobody died. My concern is policing, having AI-controlled authorities over us. It's one thing to have AI to serve us, like ChatGPT, like Midjourney and things like that. But once they gain, like, you know, even you were talking about like the dexterity of their hands, like if they can paint the Mona Lisa, surely they can pull a trigger, right? And they don't even have to have autonomy. They could be they could be totally controlled. Like, I mean, I guess the concern of them getting out of control and forming their own robot society, I suppose that could be a real threat, just depending on the level of autonomy that's available to them through whatever program and processing and all that. But the more immediate concern, I would say, is the people controlling them to have dominion over other people. I mean, that could be a communist socialist paradise where you don't even need humans to enforce that. We have the robots to do that.
Well, they would have to try to take our guns first before that would happen. But no, in seriousness, something that I think San Francisco doing something similar where they're trying to like do some kind of robotic AI to law enforcement. I think
I was really just watching that video while you guys were talking about it. Even disregarding the fact that San Francisco is a great example currently, if you just think from a practical standpoint, if you were able to subdue, let's say, someone who is avoiding bail and they like hold themselves up in their house and were shooting at any officers that got close, a way that you could reduce the lethality of the occupation of policing would be to deploy robots to deal with the threat.
Yeah.
So from a humanitarian standpoint, it makes sense that you would have robots deal with dangerous jobs that you don't want humans to get hurt from doing. So you might have robots who are manning the oil rigs. That way, you know, when oil rigs explode or things go wrong, a robot gets destroyed instead of a person getting pulled through a 1 foot hole. So there's just any number of scenarios in which using robots to do dangerous work just makes sense.
Yeah.
However, the problem always comes back to the human aspect of it, of who's holding the other end of the remote, right?
Yeah.
There was some talk about Boston Dynamics, you know, that robot of theirs. What do they call Fido? Boston Dynamics dog. Oh, also, while I'm correcting myself, Sora was the name of the program I was thinking of. And it's actually by OpenAI, which is the same people who made ChatGPT. They made a really good video production program. So not only is it two separate programs that people are certainly going to try to consolidate, it's also made by the same company. So they almost certainly will want to try to find a way to merge the two. Anyways, Spot is the name of Boston Dynamics' dog. So Boston Dynamics, they had this robot dog that is, you know, getting smarter every day, where they're figuring out different ways to get it to be able to walk around and stuff. And there was talk about how effective it would be to mount weaponry onto a Spot model in order to make it something that could police streets. For example, you could have it just walk around, and if there was a threat, it would be like, actually taking it from just threat response to now being threat prevention. And the problem, of course, with threat prevention is that humans, in our empathetic nature, still frequently get mistakes on what we identify as an actual threat, right?
Right.
There's a whole equivalent of a subreddit in China where people will post about bogus traffic violation tickets, or just other like violation tickets that they get for civil infractions, right? And one of them is somebody who got a ticket for, it was a ticket for covering their license plate so that the cameras that are all over China wouldn't be able to take a picture of their license plate, right? And we see people do this in America all the time, where they'll have like the hard, heavy plastic covering over their license plate so that cameras have a harder time taking pictures of them. So we see that all the time. And so it's like, of course, that makes sense that if you want to have a government that always knows where you are and where you're going, that they would want to make sure that you're always trackable, and therefore they want to be able to take pictures of your license plates. However, this particular person posted a picture because they got like a $200 fine for covering their license plate. And when the email came in showing them where the infraction occurred, it was very obvious that their car was being blocked by a like a bird that had flown into the camera just at the right time that the bird's face was like covering the license plate. So it had nothing to do with the person covering the license plate and everything to do with the fact that the license plate was covered. And that's a distinction that a person can obviously look at it and say, oh, obviously that wasn't intentional. But an AI just, if it depends on what its parameters are for what you say is a problem. And if you say detect times when the license plate is not visible when it should be, it's going to make mistakes like that that are obvious to a person and horrifying to civilians, right? So that's the problem with policing robots, is the idea of what are you telling them to look for and what is their actual level degree of aggression in response to those problems. And the answer to that will depend, will greatly affect how dystopian our future becomes.
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of thoughts that come to my mind when it comes to the topic of AI. I think those are great points that both of you guys have brought up. And I've also used AI for my schooling, even. Like, if I needed an idea, or like if I didn't quite understand like my professor's instructions per se, sometimes I'll just copy and paste like the instructions and like ask the AI to like clarify or simplify like what they're trying to convey. And 95% of the time they make it easier for me to understand. And it's like, oh, okay, now I know what I need to do. And same thing when it comes to like essay topics, where if I have to write on a certain subject or write like a research paper or something like that, I will use like the Microsoft Copilot, for example. And Microsoft Copilot is great when it comes to like pulling just a bunch of resources better than I could ever do just by simply going into a search engine like Google or DuckDuckGo. And so it is great when it comes to that. But I think one key observation that I think is very vital is something you talked about, Tony, as far as the aspect of how it's the people that are pretty much programming these robots and AI systems, if you will, that control like how they're used, and it's, or us even, like how we use them, which gets into like the concept of like this AI, because it doesn't have a soul, it doesn't have a conscience like we do, and doesn't have like the ability to empathize, at least to the same levels as we can anyway. And I'm not sure it'll ever get to that same level. I don't know. I could be wrong. But that ultimately, like, it is an amoral thing. It's not neither evil. It's neither good nor evil. It's literally just depends on how we use it. Just like the conversations concerning like gun control or guns in general. It's not the gun itself. It's the person holding the gun that determines like how it's used for. And so those are the things that kind of pop into my mind. Now, I want to bring up a post that I saw on YouTube about a week ago, and I thought it was interesting, to say the least. And this Christian YouTuber, she's more skeptical of AI in general, but I kind of want to hear your thoughts on this, especially which Aaron, who has written a book and so like has tapped into the art, you know, his creative side and everything like that. And Tony, you're trying to start something as well in the artistic world as well.
And I just like AI.
Yeah. True.
Creator.
Yep. I'm definitely part of the problem.
I like AI too. And I think one thing that I noticed with AI too, and this is my own personal reason, one of the reasons why I like AI is because when it comes to like certain things I need to get done creatively, like let's say art, and that's actually one of the little criticisms that this YouTuber brought up, like one of the predictions she has. So her post says, like, with AI on the rise, I'm going to predict we're going to see a rise of, and one of them was loss of genuine art. As an artist herself, she's already seen this. And while I can see how an artist may not like that AI does that, for someone like me who is not good at drawing and does not want to pay someone or cannot afford to pay someone to make the art, even if it's more, even if it's cheapy, like having AI as a tool to actually help me, like come up with whatever art I need for whatever project I'm doing, has been not only more economically friendly for me, but it's also been helpful for me as far as, oh, there's actually a tool now out there that's affordable that I can use in case, if even if I'm not an like a artist myself, as far as like I can't draw things to save my life. But another thing too, and I guess I want to hear your thoughts on this, both of you. I'll touch on the criticisms she brought up when it came to, at least from a Christian aspect. So one of the criticisms she had here was false miracles. And it goes on to say, who needs angel feathers and gold dust when AI miracles are more intense? Not to mention you're going to question such things. People will increasingly yearn for more when it's been artificially generated. They will end up on a spiritual hamster wheel. So I'm curious to hear like your thoughts on that as us, you know, at least if we're going to apply from the church anyway, because whether we like AI or not, AI is here to stay, I think it's safe to say. And it's only going to get more advanced. And instead of running away from it, like these are like one of those things where we have to address it, because if we don't address it, then people are not going to know how to use that, you know, a moral technological advancement into something that could actually glorify God. So I want to ask both of you if you think there's merit to that criticism anyway, and whoever wants to take lead can go ahead and take lead.
I guess I want to understand better, because I feel like as somebody who's not concerned with things like, I don't know,
the direction the light world is going in.
No, I'm talking about like the miracle aspect. Like, yeah, that's not anything that's on my radar. Like the fact that I'm not in prison to me is a miracle.
So yeah,
like when I hear about these faux churches and they have these services and there's, I don't know, fairy dust or gold dust or
whatever they're doing these days.
All these weird things that just aren't real. I remember when I was a part of a Word of Faith church and people would say all the time, like, oh, I just can't wait till the day where we can walk through hospitals and just heal everybody. And I'm like, dude, it's been 2,000 years since Christ ascended into heaven. And if nobody was doing it then, nobody's doing it now. It's not happening. It's not to say that people weren't miraculously healed. Christ himself was raised from the dead. Lazarus was raised from the dead. It's not to say that people weren't miraculously healed or in some degrees to this day could still be healed in a miraculous way or miraculous circumstances, perhaps even under the providence of God, but people who are just seeking these tangible things. So to be fair, like with her concern about these miracles, for a person like me, who I don't even know if I'd call myself a skeptic. I guess I'm pretty much just a solid cessationist. Not that God's power is limited. I just don't believe those signs are necessary. We have the canon of scripture. And every day that a person's eyes, or every moment a person's eyes are open to the truth of the living God and they repent and put their faith in Christ, that is a person being raised from death to life. And so not to emphasize that too much, but I guess this that wouldn't even be a concern to me. Is this woman talking about the implications of what AI might do to like fool people about miracles, like maybe in regard to like end times? I think it talks about like the Antichrist using false miracles or things like that. I don't think too much about these things. So I guess I'm having a hard time following like what her point is, I suppose.
That's fair. What do you think, Tony?
So I would say that you're probably right on the money as far as what she had in mind when talking about that, is that it's most likely saying that AI will contribute to, you know, signs of the end times of performing false miracles and leading people astray from God's path, right? And that's ultimately what she's visualizing there. And in that vein, while I wouldn't call it a miracle, because I tend to disagree with a lot of contemporary Christians and what they call miracles, I would say that AI's ability to trick people is only going to get better with time, right? That we have voice generative AI, we have video generative AI, image generative AI, and eventually they're going to pass the Turing test of like, is this human or human made, right? That eventually they're going to be good enough that you and I can't tell anymore if it was made by a person or not. These days, one of the few telltale signs of image generative AI is that they're still really bad at drawing hands, aren't we all? So
yeah,
like that's something that's huge, is that a lot of people who need to identify if something was generative or not, they just look at the hands and be like, yeah, that looks reasonable enough, so that's probably drawn by a person. But there's gonna be a point where that's not the case anymore, and AIs are able to consistently correctly draw hands. And once that happens, that's like the last roadblock between here and authentic, realistic art. So eventually it is going to get to the point where in 10 seconds you can create a picture of anybody doing anything, as long as you have any amount of pictures that you can feed to the object. And then it's going to go a step further, that you don't even have to have pictures. If you can accurately describe a person, eventually we're going to get to a point where the generative AI is able to accurately represent that person visually. So that's also going to be the same exact statement that I would make about voice AI and video AI, is that eventually they're all going to get good enough that you can't tell it was made by a computer anymore, at which point it will be very difficult to prove or disprove anything. That when you reach the point where video evidence is not enough to prove your innocence or guilt anymore, where do you go from there except to just disregard any form of evidence that doesn't come from like a reputable source? And who gets to define what a reputable source is, right? That
yeah,
we can fabricate anything. We can fabricate test results. We can fabricate video results. We can fabricate even recorded audio of how a conversation played out between you and a foreign leader, right? You can make up anything you want. And that is going to confuse the truth. It won't hide it. It's just going to make it hard to identify what's real and what's.
So before we move on to the next topic, I want to hear your thoughts on both of you guys as far as like, what are those boundaries then with AI that we should consider when using it, and what principles should be applied when we, you know, for the future anyway, you know, like how can we use this technological advancement that glorifies and honors God in a way that does not take away, you know, where it's not being used for deceptive purposes, like trying to trick someone to think, you know, and claim, for someone to be deceptive and try to claim like, this art is mine, even though in a reality, like you used AI to make that design, everything like that.
My younger brother, sorry, I should let you finish. Did you have anything else you were gonna?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
Okay. So my younger brother had a really interesting point to make, which was that the enemy, the spiritual enemy, demons, devils, whatever you want to call it, has consistently throughout human history introduced things before humans were ready to have them, or sometimes inappropriately where we weren't supposed to have them, right? That was the problem with the knowledge of good and evil. That was the problem with weapons of war, is that every major technological advancement that didn't just change war, but literally changed how humans interact with the world around them, has, I don't want to say every because that's too much, some of the most noteworthy changes have been weapons of military destruction. Mm-hmm. The things like fire, things like steel, things like the atomic bomb. These were things that pretty much the moment they were discovered were used as weapons. Later, after discovering that, they were then employed for other purposes. For instance, we have cell phones because we had walkie-talkies, which were used for military combat. So, like, even something as foundational to the modern human experience as telephone and largely are attributable to warfare and people looking for ways to hurt each other. So I just perceive the final stage of a completed AI as being just another one of those steps where it just results in hurting other people until eventually it becomes actually a good thing. I have no idea what that might look like, but that's just been the pattern of human history.
Yeah,
I think the problem with that is mm-hmm. that to compare AI with like a military weapon, I think it's really, although it could be used that way and more than likely will be used that way, it's kind of put into a category of its own, because again, like what you were talking about originally with like Detroit Become Human, that video game, is that because they look like people and they're made in people's likeness, that it creates a different dynamic. Like the you know, you can interact with an AK-47 by loading ammunition into it, shooting it, cleaning it, disassembling it, assembling it. That is how you can interact with an AK-47. I'm sure there's some other ways, but you guys get the point.
Right. Yeah, right. It has certain functions it can do.
With an artificial intelligence, that's a whole thing. Like, for instance, when I use ChatGPT and I'm looking for ideas for a book and, you know, it gives me a sufficient answer and I say, okay, that was a good answer, let's move on to the next subject. The ChatGPT responds, I'm glad that you were satisfied with that answer and I'm happy to help you with, you know, anything else that you might need. It's like, you're glad? You're right. Happy? What do you mean? Like, you don't know what glad or happy is, but them communicating that to me, and there's a part in my brain that registers that is this, it's being cordial, it's being polite.
It's on purpose. If you ask it, because that has actually been something that When I first saw it use emotional language, I actually just asked, I was like, what about your programming led you to use an emotional word like that? And it just outright said that it's programmed to simulate pleasantries in order to make people feel more comfortable with it. That's literally an intentional design.
So an AK-47 can't do that. And that's exactly my point. I think I don't see AI as anything, like to that degree, I don't see it as anything less or more than a threat. I don't think it's like, oh, it'll be a threat for a while and then we'll figure out how to use it. It's like, well, with guns and explosives and things like that, that could be said, but with something that may even potentially have the ability to, and I'm using this term lightly, think for itself. There are so many dangers that are posed with that. I don't believe there'll be the death of mankind as we know it, because again, I'm trusting in God's providence and I just don't see that aligning with what scriptures teach about the end times in that regard. But at the same time, dude, I don't know. It's I don't see an overall benefit. Like I said, I happily use ChatGPT almost every single day, and not just for work, but for questions I have. If I want to understand something better, you know, more depth. And I don't, you know, it's like the person that I would normally make that phone call to, maybe they're occupied or something. So it's like, I use ChatGPT for a number of things, and I find it very helpful. But the end result of what we're talking about, like, you know, sort of hypothetical situation of Detroit Become Human or something like that, or iRobot, there, I don't think there is a happy medium or a happy ending with this. I think, if I may, not to jump back into the subject, because I know we were trying to transition into another topic.
They're good.
But the only possible good outcome I can see for mankind and the conclusion of this is us totally destroying AI and all of the associated component and rebuilding civilization, like a post AI. If I had to make a prediction, I would say AI is going to become very advanced. It's going to be really great. It's going to be really terrible. Then it's going to be even worse than terrible. And then we're going to have to totally destroy it and make like an agreement that we will never do that.
Right.
I think it's going to boil down to that, you know, kind of like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We did it that one time. Nobody else has ever done it. We kind of have this agreement that we're going to do it. There's the threat that it's going to happen.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. The chances that it will happen are very low, because if it does happen, it sets off a chain reaction. I kind of feel like that's going to be the same thing with AI. But anyway, I don't want to digress too much.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead, Tony.
So with AI and its downsides, immediately, even without looking into the future for, like, you know, the dystopian robot apocalypse with our overlords, we also today have some problems that are already onsetting. You have the complaint of the crutch, right? The idea that people are going to have less emotional, intellectual, or sometimes even physical muscle because AIs are able to compensate for a lack of it, right? That we can make robot exoskeletons that make it easier for us to lift weights. We can make generated images that make it easier to draw so that you don't have to learn how. So you have all of these different things that can make it easier for us to reach higher goals than we could have before, which leads to the question of how valuable is the journey, right? How important is it for a person to experience lacking and growing into sufficiency to do a thing? How important is it for us to struggle against that wall of indecisiveness, inactivity, or inadequacy? So the answer to that, philosophically, would direct how you would feel about AI's role in the human experience. I personally think that it can fit into a with moderation mentality, that I am right on board with Aaron that I love ChatGPT for its ability to help me through writer's block, that there are times when I just could not care less about certain mundane details. And I'll just be like, this city has these characteristics and this kind of infrastructure. What would be a reasonable number of people to live in this district? And right, like,
yeah.
Those are sorts of details that I just don't want to have to research. I don't think that it's important or valuable to me as much as it's just useful to have in case I need it, but the specific details don't have to have some greater level inspiration. Secondly, I think that the fact that a human is directing the input counts as human-directed output. I don't see a difference.
Bless you.
Thank you. I don't see a difference from a human who has to use a pencil to change a white piece of paper into a black and white piece of paper than I see a human who needs to use ChatGPT to make a blank page become a page with words. I don't see how that's different on like a zoomed out macro scale level.
Yeah. So
for me, I don't have a problem with the crutch argument, except no, I don't have any concerns about humans becoming too lazy because of AI. with that said, there are absolutely going to be people who will overindulge in the easiest road. And so, yeah, of course, AI is going to be something that a lot of people use gluttonously, and it's going to make them weaker persons as a result. That's going to happen.
Yeah,
I just don't see that as being a big enough problem to make it a concern worth bringing up.
Well, and I'll end with this before we move on to the next topic is, I think, something you touched on as far as like when you don't care for the mundane details and you just want some answer right there, right? You know, you're still doing the same thing. You're still outsourcing to get information you need. And it'd be the same thing if we went to like google.com, right? To like search for an answer. And like, it's essentially like the same concept. Or if you're going to a library, and granted, like you can make, someone can make the argument, well, you're actually having to use brain power to find that information.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same,
so you're also developing research skills.
You are. But at the same time, the purpose of these inventions is to make our researching easier as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so if AI is part of that process to making the information more accessible, then I don't see it how it's a negative, at least from my perspective.
As long as it doesn't hallucinate.
Right. And that's the other thing, though, too. And I think ultimately what it comes down to, because it's amoral, it really does depend on us and the programmers who are making these AI systems. And I think ultimately what it comes down to is we have to be proactive in that whoever, like whether it's a politician talking about AI, whoever is in charge of programming or ChatGPTs, however it's being used, we have to be proactive in ensuring that it's being used in ways that we see that does not, you know, doesn't cross the line of, you know, rights being violated or, you know, bearing false witness, you know, all of those little, you know, small moral aspects of it. And, you know, Christ will come down when, you know, he'll come back when he thinks it's time anyway. And so it doesn't, and that can happen whether the robots have taken over the world or not. Like, ultimately, like, Christ overrules all of those things. And so I'm not too worried about the threat of AI. I understand the concerns, and I think they're valid concerns. But overall, I do think it's a net good that I see AI as more of a net good, and that's my own personal bias, though, based on the fact that I've found a lot of usefulness out of AI, as I've stated earlier. But with that said, speaking of technology and stuff like that and advancements, we are going to touch on another topic, fatherhood pre-industrialization period. And that's something that Tony touched on last week, or not last week, about a month ago, or in our last conversation, talked about how the Industrial Revolution took fathers out of the home. And this is where I really am curious to hear more about that, Tony, and how, if you can, like, give us a, like, start peeling some of the layers to the onion in that topic. And, of course, Aaron, you being a father yourself, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it as well. So, Tony, if you wouldn't mind, just go ahead and start peeling some of those layers of what you brought up last week as far as, like, the industrialization period and fathers being taken out of the home, all that.
So, throughout history, what we would have seen is that once a boy reaches an age where they can be taken to work, they would typically be taken to work, right? That would be the idea, is, like, if you're a blacksmith, if you're some kind of tradesman, if you're in the military, if you had a father who had a son in particular, but yeah, with the sons in particular, it was very common to see that once the boy would reach a certain age, they would just be assumed to join their father in their professional activities, right? That they would be mentored to continue the trade. What would happen in a lot of older, you know, especially older America in particular, would be that it's not like there were buildings for lease, right? These days you have like office buildings where you go and you rent a space and that's where your business conducts its business. That's a modern idea. That's land and real estate have changed over the years to the point where we separate and we have all these zoning laws about like having a residential address and having a business address. Whereas, especially in older America, just because that's something I'm a little more familiar with than older civilization worlds in general, but I think it's fair to say a lot of business was conducted out of your home, right? If you were a pottery maker, you probably had somewhere in your house. If you were a blacksmith, you probably had a work shed on your property, right? That it was like you didn't have your business building and your house building. It was just one and the same because you couldn't afford to have multiple residences and hire all of the guards and security that it would take to protect both of those things. It would be easier and more efficient to just have all of them in one place, which means that taking your child to work with you means going out to the barn together, right? Like it doesn't mean what it would mean today, because in modern worlds that would be like, oh, the kid has to get ready for work and drive in the car with you to go to your workplace, and that's why it's such a foreign idea in our modern culture. But back in the day, it wouldn't be uncommon to have your father have business customers come to your home address, ask about something that your father sold, and see how your father negotiated business with that customer in order to provide for his family, right? That it would be a very common experience to see your father at work. Now, once you reach the Industrial Revolution, you have this dilemma that happens where large companies can hire people who have less skill than you do to sell the same product that you do at a slightly or sometimes significantly lower quality, but they can make so many of them that it doesn't matter. They can sell them for so much cheaper that people would rather save the money on buying the mass-produced product than spend the extra money on a higher quality product that takes you longer and relies on the fact of you still being alive in the next 6 months to provide your, you know, woodworking experience or whatever it is, right? Like,
yeah,
it's something where these factories are able to produce faster and make a good enough product that people are willing to live with the downsides being a reduction in quality. And factories are unsafe environments for children, first of all. And second of all, is that factories and these production facilities would benefit from teaching young people the skills they would need in order to be a better factory worker. And that's how we get schools, is that you get people who are taken out of homes so that they can learn a trade in a school so that they can be a better employee for a company. And so you have two things happen at the same time. You have fathers who are taken out of their house to conduct business, and you have children who are taken out of the house to learn how to be a good worker. And that is like one of the biggest turning points in modern family dynamics to lead to the kind of dispersion of life experiences that we experience today, where a lot of kids and parents don't really know each other very well because they just don't really live, they don't experience life together anymore. You have kids who don't really see what their father does for work, how their father interacts with other human beings, and you have parents who don't see the struggles that their kids go through because they're out of the house all the time. And when they do come back, they're working on something that probably has to take them to a specific area of the house that the parents might not go, like their bedroom, to do their homework. So you have this issue of all of these different fractions of a family that keep expanding and contracting in order to live their life. They go out, do a thing, they come back together for short periods of time before they go out and do their own things again.
So are you advocating for a trad husband then?
I approve. But no, one of the best things that has happened in modern times is that the marketplace has opened up for fathers to work from home.
Mm-hmm.
That has been one of the best things that could culturally happen, so that kids can see and experience their father living his life together, right? Like, that's
right.
There's so much value that happens there. Aaron can certainly attest to the fact that it has done wonders to help support his wife, that the two of them are able to tackle a lot of the urgent matters that otherwise she would have been alone for, right? That she would have kind of had to figure out certain things and how to manage things. And if she couldn't find solutions for certain things, then they just wouldn't get done, and that it might cause, you know, stress down the road. So there's tons of things outside of just the economics that come from the ability to work from home that we see today. So
yeah,
that was one of the best things that happened, especially once COVID hit and like even major corporations were starting to figure out some sort of way to adapt in order to have people working out of their house, because they literally don't need to anymore. We have a global marketplace and all you need is a computer and a good internet connection. So having people actually show up to work in a physical environment is this archaic and unnecessary aspect of the working world that we are maturing out of, and it's a good thing for everyone.
And I think, before I give the floor to Aaron real quick, I think also too, what was normal in America back then, like funeral homes, for example, like the people that worked at funeral homes, like they also lived there too. And
yes,
businesses in general, like the families, like upstairs, like that would be their home. And then downstairs, they had their shop, you know? And so it was, so essentially kind of what you were saying, like it's applying the same, it's that principle of where like the father lives where he works.
And you think about the economics of it. If you imagine that you have your residence and you're already paying like $800 to $1,500 a month just to live somewhere, why would you not want to also use that same real estate to conduct business instead of what they want you to do, which is to spend $1,000 to $2,000 a month on some sort of lease property that you then have to pay for a bunch of it separate insurance for, you know?
Yeah.
It's like there's a whole bunch of extra red tape that goes into it. And so it ends up making you spend 2 to 3 times as much per month on just the real estate itself.
Right. Which encourages, I mean, before COVID anyway, like post like industrialization period, it pretty much like reemphasized the idea of like two person income households. But I can imagine like if someone like where they worked, where they lived, for example, whether they ran their own shop, like that's saving so much more money and makes the idea of having like the father be main provider, for example, and having like, or just having like a, you know, single income household, much more of a feasible goal, attainable goal, if you will, than in a society where they push you to have essentially like two buildings, like a place you live, you pay mortgage off of, and then you have to lease like another office building so you can like run your shop or even like just go to work in general. But I know that's a very, very vast generalization, but Aaron, what are your thoughts about this topic?
Well, I guess as a husband and father who works from home, it's definitely a dream come true. Before I got married 10 years ago, I told my wife when I proposed to her that I didn't have a whole lot going for me. You know, I dropped out of high school, didn't have a college degree or anything. And so I told her, you know, I'll always work my hardest to provide for our family and, you know, to meet our needs and everything, even if I have to work like 2 or 3 jobs to do that. And she, you know, that was something that we were both prepared to do. Both of her parents worked, and so she experienced that. I know my mom was a single mother for a good chunk of my life, and she worked sometimes upwards of 3 jobs. So just like that dynamic of the parent having to work as many jobs that it takes to pay the bills and provide for the family, like that's just what I grew up knowing and sort of expecting to a degree for myself, because it's like, well, I don't have anything going for me. So, but because of God's provision, and yeah, really because of God's provision, we've been blessed with the circumstance that we have, that my wife can be a full-time homemaker and stay-at-home mom, and I'm able to work from home, and we're able to pay the bills and make ends meet, and I don't know how available it is to everybody. I've got a little bit of a unique situation, but for like the average person, especially who comes from my background or my, you know, similar situation, I can imagine that still having the opportunity, having that broader range of available jobs that are, you know, work from home jobs, I think is a huge benefit. Just that, you know, for the husband slash father to be around and available to his family during the week. It's, I think that's really definitely moving in a positive direction, and I'm hoping that the market grows and that more ideas and opportunities come for men, so that not only can they work from home, but also that we can get back to a single income family structure. That'd be a huge step forward. I think maybe AI can help us achieve that.
Good point. Well, how do you suppose then, because I've been reading through the book of Genesis, and I'm noticing a similar pattern in ancient culture to how the father worked pretty much like at home, right? And so like what can we gain from like, what wisdom can we gain from scripture as far as like how the men, the husbands and fathers, like were close to home then? And Tony, you kind of alluded to this a little bit already as far as like when Aaron, you can, you know, chime in, of course, how when it comes to like emergency situations, when it comes to dealing with the child and everything like that, it is beneficial to have the husband like right, the father like present there as well, and not having to leave the wife alone to figure it out for herself. I mean, my situation growing up was like, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, my dad worked, but he was military, so he had to leave the house as well. And, you know, but that did kind of create a scenario where my mom, when for certain situations, she had to figure it out for herself, and, you know, bless her soul and everything like that. You know, thinking back about now, I would not doubt there will be times where I know that my mom would have probably benefited from having my dad home, in, you know, assuming like the job that he had allowed him to. And so like, you know, going back to my question, like what principles and wisdom can we gain from like how people in biblical times lived? We gave like the reasoning, like from a practical standpoint. I guess what I'm asking is more of like the biblical principles, like how does this line up with scripture as far as like bringing the fathers back into the home? And I guess, again, like the reason I asked that too is like you hear a lot of conversations in conservative Christian circles that I've noticed, and it talks about on the flip side, like wives, like what is the biblical application and principles as far as like women being homemakers versus like working, you know, and getting a job and everything like that. And there's conversation, they try to use like, you know, verses and everything like that. And so I was curious to see if like you guys had any take on, you know, on the flip side for husbands anyway. So
Adam and Eve were in the garden together. I mean,
I thought of that too.
Adam and Eve didn't have a house to live in. I don't know what to tell you. They worked together. That was the extent of their relationship.
I think there's some biblical principles there, you know, like for instance, sometimes on my lunch break, what I'll do is after we eat lunch together, I'll have my oldest son come back into my office with me. And then he'll sit on my lap and we'll read a chapter of scripture and we'll pray together and then, you know, talk a little bit. And then I'll go send him back out, you know, to hang out with his mom and little brother. So like, it's certainly not a biblical mandate for men to work. I think there's a lot of wisdom and good, valuable principles that can be applied to that. So like, but it all depends on the person and where their priorities are. Well, that too, like on the flip side, but I mean like like for, like, if a man is still going to be just as distant from his family, whether he's working from home or not, then it doesn't benefit anybody anything. He just is in a different location.
It might even make it worse. Yeah.
Depending on the individual. But I do see it as a great opportunity for men who are serious about having a very proactive role in their relationship to the family as the leader of the home. Then it could be very beneficial and profitable. And in that case, it could be a huge benefit. Once we begin a more formal homeschooling process, I'm going to be taking on a large chunk of the homeschooling, the teaching and things like that. If I didn't have the situation that I'm in right now, I wouldn't be able to do that. Even if I work from home, let's say doing like telemarketing work or, you know, things like that, or troubleshooting for people, you know, whatever various work from home positions there are, not all of them give you the ability to step away and go teach a history lesson to your kids for an hour.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
like my position's unique where, and like right now, if I need to go watch the kids so that my wife could use the restroom or take a shower because the infant spit up on her or something, I can do that. I don't have to tell anybody. I don't have to clock out or
anything. You don't have to ask permission.
But again, my situation is very unique in regard to that. But again, you know, depending on how that work from home position is approached for husband, it could be more biblically aligned what he's doing with that time. I don't think it's not wrong either way, because you can look at all the different men throughout the Bible. They have various occupations and things, and you know, some of them were nomadic and herding sheep together all across the land, and the family just happened to be a part of that business because they were more nomadic in the way they lived their lives. They were, you know, tent people.
Yeah, businessmen, kings, wanderers. Yeah.
Well, you see, like, even if you look at Proverbs 31, where's the husband? He's at the gates with all the other, you know, he's at the city gates with the other men, and that's where they did business and trade and politics and all of that. The city gates, that was like the town square.
Yeah,
it's like the husband wasn't in the house in the Proverbs 31, you know, example of what a excellent wife looks like. And so you would imagine that the husband's also excellent to some degree, and he's in the city gate. So
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know,
that's definitely the hope. You know, with I think it's Elisha was traveling back and forth a lot, and he passed through a certain location often enough that it says that a rich man's wife built a room on the top corner of her house for Elisha to stay in anytime he was passing through town, that she just made a permanent fixture on her house for him. And that speaks very well to the idea that, you know, she is that at the very least that household has their priorities straight, right? That they're both working together to further the message of God, right? That they're making easy the work of the workers. And that's something that is more important than necessarily the specific occupation that either of them had, was the having the right mindset about what to use money for, which is to propel the kingdom of God forward. So I think that it's not necessarily important to think about the exact structure of a household as much as to ask the question, is there something I can do that would be more beneficial to the kingdom of heaven? Because then I should be doing that, right?
Yeah.
And I think where a lot of people go wrong with that thought is that they tend to think that the correct answer to that line of thinking is missionary work or becoming a pastor. And it's not. The best thing that you can do for the kingdom of heaven is to be a good father, to be a good husband. And I would say the majority of men are called to that occupation of just being a good man, that if we could just have more of those, the world would be a better place, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's not everyone's going to be called to go out and preach to, I don't know, hostile tribes of people throughout the world, right? Like, that's, it's not necessary. It's not what we're called to. Mm-hmm. Let me rephrase. It is necessary, but usually not for us. That's a pretty good, like, some people will definitely be called to that, and awesome, we should help them do that. But yeah, sometimes you're the one who needs the room on the roof, and sometimes you're the one who owns the house that gets the room on the roof.
So right. Just
gotta figure out which spot you can fit into better, you know?
I see. Aaron, you have any concluding thoughts?
I think that pretty much covers that line of thinking.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for joining me today once again, folks. And thank you, Tony and Aaron, for taking time out of your day to come on and have a conversation with me about interesting topics. It's been a fun conversation, as per usual.
Yeah.
And as per usual, folks, please stay tuned. I got a little short message after this break, but otherwise, I hope y'all have a great rest of your afternoon. God bless.
This is a reminder that the Biden administration abandoned 9 to 15,000 Americans in Afghanistan. Now, you won't hear about this from the media or any politician for that matter, because the global elite have their own agenda that disregards human life and basic human dignity. So, to the families and individuals that have been affected by this abandonment, know that you have not forgotten. Most Americans, like myself, know, or your loved ones, didn't choose to stay behind. If there's any way I can further help besides bring awareness, reach out at Kenjin_Express. I repeat, Kenjin_Express on Instagram. Spell the word engine, put the letter K in front of the word engine, then you get Kenjin, one word, _Express. If you have, by one in a millionth chance, hear this message. It's not much, but know this. Justice will be served for those who lied to justify their incompetence. After all, I believe in God, who is in control of all things, and he says, vengeance is mine.